Welcome to a podcast of a sermon delivered at the Unitarian Society of Ridgewood in New Jersey. Our congregation is a place where you will find inspiration in the richness of diverse beliefs and the power of community. Detailed information about the Unitarian Society of Ridgewood is available on our website, uuridgewood.org.
I was wondering how the change in times would affect us. If we happen still to be in the room at 11, as 11 approaches, just welcome warmly those who come in who have not changed their clocks. On February 26, 2012, George Zimmerman shot and killed Trayvon Martin in Sanford, Florida. As Alicia Garza puts it, Trayvon Martin was posthumously put on trial. And on July 13, 2013, Zimmerman was acquitted of all charges. Following the trial, Garza, Patrice Cullors, and Opal Tometi created the hashtag Black Lives Matter. In the 2.5 years since, that hashtag has become a movement. A year after Zimmerman's acquittal, on July 17, 2014, police on Staten Island essentially choked Eric Garner to death. His crime was selling Lucy's, single cigarettes. That same summer, on August 9th, Ferguson, Missouri, police officer Darren Wilson shot and killed Michael Brown, whose body lay in the street for 4 hours. Citizens of Ferguson rose up, and many who had not yet paid attention to or joined Black Lives Matter were paying attention. This is at the start of my second year as interim minister of the Unitarian Universalists of Clearwater, Florida, which is about 90 minutes by car from Sanford. Now, the Clearwater congregation, like USR, has a strong history of and commitment to social justice. And with many members of that congregation, I had been working with a network of 38 congregations in Pinellas County known as Faith and Action for Strength Together. The issues we worked on included such things as the arrests of children in school and filing criminal charges against them. At the same time that there was an alternative which the county sheriff used, but not as much as he could have, of what were called civil citations, which would not result in a criminal record. And in other counties in Florida, civil citations were used even less. In a few, they were used more. The idea that the police were called regularly into the schools was something I found astounding. Now, FAST had already succeeded in getting the city of St. Petersburg to require the hiring of former felons as one-third of the workforce on any city contract. In this, we were addressing both ends of the school-to-prison pipeline, which many of you know about. Schools failing to educate children, leaving them in communities with few job opportunities other than criminal activity. Now, in the past, in Pinellas County, there had been issues of excessive police violence in at least two of the county's three cities with 100,000 or more residents, Clearwater and St. Petersburg. But there was a general agreement that while policing was not yet perfect, it was much fairer than it had been in past years, and much fairer and more measured than in many Florida communities. But the rage over Ferguson spread. More and more instances of police killings of unarmed, usually black civilians in other places were in the news. Now, I am not personally convinced that there were more such instances than in the past. I'm convinced that the mass media had not been paying attention to them because black lives didn't matter. In any event, the number of deaths shocked people who are usually hard to shock. So the Social Justice Council of the Unitarian Universalists of Clearwater needed to take a lead in that particular city. So in consultation with the council, I called a community meeting in the Octagon, which was their meeting house. Just over 20 individuals attended on December 10th, 2014. And in addition to a group of Unitarian Universalists, there were members of other faith communities, the director of Clearwater's Martin Luther King Community Center, a retired police officer, and two members of the Black Lives Matter group that had formed in St. Petersburg, a 25-minute drive to the south, and the county's most diverse city. The discussions we had that evening were open and honest. The Black Lives Matter group welcomed our support in their actions, but they were in no way interested in being co-opted by a bunch of middle-aged white liberals. The retired police officer, who was black, reminded us that not all police officers were out of control. But he, too, both in policing and in civilian life, had experienced the effects of racism. The problems were real, and we knew that. And with the Black Lives Members group centered in St. Petersburg, a group that sometimes crossed the bay to launch actions in the larger city of Tampa, the other side of Tampa Bay, we all discussed what we could do in the northern part of Pinellas County, where Clearwater is located. Now, to give you a little more context, Pinellas County is the most densely populated county in Florida. People who have been to Miami are surprised that Miami-Dade is not. But Pinellas County is the most densely populated county. It is racially and economically diverse. And it has its issues. We organized a vigil to put Black Lives Matter in the public eye in Clearwater. And we had this at the Clearwater Circle, a traffic circle, which every vehicle going to Clearwater Beach, a major tourist attraction, has to go through. It was January when he had the vigil, and beach traffic was, of course, heavy. For 2 hours, we held up signs that had messages such as Black Lives Matter here. Now, remember, Florida may have a lot of retired New Yorkers and Midwesterners, but it is still the South. From the cars going around the circle, we received curses, hand gestures, and cheers. One shuttle van driver, a black man, drove around the circle with a load of passengers going from the Tampa airport to the beach hotels. As he drove around the circle, he looked straight ahead. About a half hour later, returning with an empty van, he smiled and waved at us and gave us a thumbs up. A middle-aged black man driving a truck full of landscaping equipment with a couple of his employees sitting in the front seat of the truck with him slowed down and yelled thank you as he went around the circle. I learned later that his nephew was my next-door neighbor in Florida. A white biker cheered us. And the curses, you don't need to hear them, except for one shouted comment that was reminiscent of what civil rights workers heard 50 or more years ago in the South. Go back to where you came from. Now, not only were half of the people in this vigil at least Florida natives, but the car had Canadian plates on it. It's now a year later, and Black Lives Matter in St. Petersburg and Faith in Action for Strength Together are supporting each other's actions related to juvenile justice and education issues, which negatively impact children of color throughout the county. Now, this vigil in Clearwater, Florida, was not my first action around the use of excessive force against black people in the United States. That would have been in 1978, when I was invited to become active in the Citizens Commission on Police Repression in Los Angeles, a multiracial and multicultural countywide coalition with a focus on many and a wide array of police abuses of civil liberties, from wiretapping to excessive violence to arbitrary stops. Now, CCOPR conveniently was pronounced copper, a cultural reference of sorts. And I was a member of the steering committee of COPPER on behalf of the Unitarian Universalists of Metropolitan Los Angeles. COPPER worked closely with the Coalition on Police Abuse, a black organization based in South Central LA that focused on police violence. Well, interestingly enough, South Central LA and Pasadena. Pasadena is a much more racially diverse community than you would know from watching The Big Bang Theory. And it had its problems with police use of excessive force. Well, police violence was rampant under Chief Daryl Gates, who was there at the time. One might say almost that police on patrol were out of control. Now, the membership of these two groups overlapped, but we recognize that there was a good reason to have two organizations, one countywide and representing an array of issues affecting various ethnicities and cultures, the other focused on the issues of excessive force targeted mostly against black residents of Los Angeles and adjacent cities. Because black lives did not matter to the largely white LA Police Department, that organization had to be where the focus on police violence was, in the black community. I describe all of this to tell you that the issues raised and held up by Black Lives Matter are not new issues. But now is the time when there's an opportunity to address them at a level and to an extent that they have never been addressed before. Before people get inured to seeing the violence and lose their outrage, before the mass media turn their attention totally elsewhere. Now, I mentioned the example of Los Angeles in the 1970s and early 1980s, but this is not the first time that devotion to the worth and inherent dignity of every person, the first principle of Unitarian Universalism, has demanded an emphasis on the worth and dignity of a particular group in our society. We Unitarian Universalists have a long history of taking specific stances in line with our universalizing principles. Go back to the 1840s and 50s and 60s, because black slaves' lives didn't matter as much as white lives, even poor white lives. Unitarians and Universalists were active in the struggle to end slavery. Slave owners valued black lives only for the economic productivity. The rule of thumb was a slave was worth 10,000 times the price of a pound of cotton. Commentators were appalled when there were sometimes bubbles in the prices of slaves, and a slave who might have been worth $400 ordinarily was sold for $800. That's how black lives mattered in the South then, which is to say, not at all. But the opponents of slavery said in words appropriate to their time that black lives mattered. In the 1950s and 60s, because black lives did not matter as much as white lives, Unitarian Universalists were involved in the civil rights movement. In 1969, the Unitarian Universalist Association debated how best to support civil rights as an institution. And through a long and complicated struggle, which some of you may have been involved in, there was a dichotomy between those pursuing a traditional integrationist route, whose organization went by the name BAWA, and a black empowerment group, BAC, that focused on developing and supporting power in the black community. It was a long struggle over the best strategy, and it was messy. I'm told that the Unitarian Society of Ridgewood came down on the side of BAC, the Black Affairs Council. Black empowerment through financial grants and investments. And I was reminded that earlier in the 1940s, the society had invested in integrated housing in Ridgewood, long before that was a popular endeavor. In the 1960s and 70s, because Vietnamese lives did not matter as much as white lives, Unitarian Universalists were involved in the anti-war movement. We declared that Vietnamese lives mattered. Through much of the 20th century until today, Unitarian Universalists have actively supported a woman's right to choose when and how to have children and to have an abortion if she chose to. This is a declaration that women's lives matter. At least since the AIDS pandemic struck gay men in the U.S., because gay and lesbian and bisexual and transgendered lives didn't matter as much as straight white lives, Unitarian Universalists became involved in GLBT support and activism. The lynching of Matthew Shepard shocked us. The rainbow flags on many Unitarian Universalist meeting houses declared that GLBTQ lives matter. In the 1980s, because black South Africans did not matter as much as white South African lives, Unitarian Universalists were involved in the anti-apartheid movement. We declared that black South African lives matter. Over the last 10 or dozen years, the lives of non-documented brown immigrants have not mattered as much as white lives. Unitarian Universalists, under the banner of No More Deaths, have provided water on the routes that undocumented migrants take into Arizona. This is a declaration that brown lives matter. We have a history of supporting the lives and safety of particular groups at a particular time as history has demanded it of us. To me, Black Lives Matter is an imperative today, because black lives have never mattered as much as white lives. And this, of course, has been true through Western history and U.S. history. This reality is part of the structural racism that defines American society. At the founding, it was incorporated in the Constitution by counting a slave as 3/5 of a person, but without any vote at all. 255 years of slavery are part of our history. Reconstruction ended only 10 years after the Civil War and Jim Crow set in. Because black lives didn't matter, 3,446 blacks were lynched between 1882 and 1968. And the recent actions of police officers such as Darren Wilson in Ferguson and the officers who ganged up on Eric Garner in Staten Island and the one who shot Tamir Rice, a child in Cleveland, and the officers who arrested Sarah Bland in Texas, and mavericks like George Zimmerman, the list could go on. Their actions look to me like 21st century lynchings. There's always an argument in these cases as to why the victim deserved what he or she got. Throughout my 38 or so years of ministry, I have worked with local police, and I've worked against police misconduct. I work closely with police to stop drug dealing on the street in front of my church and the elementary school next door in one town. I support the police union fundraisers in my hometown. But I've also worked in coalitions investigating and campaigning against police misconduct and to change policies such as stop and frisk. Most police officers are honest, hardworking individuals doing their best to perform a necessary and difficult job. But we live in a nation that was founded on the genocide of Native peoples and the enslavement of Africans. Today, as it was the case during the period known as Jim Crow, the black male is the generalized target of white America. The school-to-prison pipeline demonizes black males and locks up large numbers for offenses for which white men walk free. The broken windows theory of policing gives cover to excessively violent officers. Stop and frisk is part of broken windows. There are many more black teens and adult males shot dead for no defensible reason, whose lives and deaths do not appear in the mass media. I recall one example soon after I arrived in Los Angeles in 1977 of a black teenager hopping a fence in the suburban San Fernando Valley being shot dead by police officers. One story in the paper and then it disappeared. And then in suburban New Jersey, not long after I came to this state in 1981, and this might have been in 1982, an unarmed teenager shoplifted a bottle of liquor in Highland Park, right across the Raritan River from New Brunswick. The police chased him, he hid under a porch, and a police officer pushed his gun under the porch and fired it, and the teenager was killed. That disappeared from the press very quickly, too. Today, it would not disappear so quickly. In 1999, Earl Faison, a black man arrested as a suspect in the killing of a black police officer, was beaten to death by five officers, four white and one black. Well, he officially died of an asthma attack, but not until after he'd been pepper sprayed, struck, and thrown down a flight of stairs in the police station. The county prosecutor declined to prosecute the officers for homicide. But eventually the five officers were all convicted on federal civil rights charges, and four were dismissed from the police force. One had retired almost immediately after the incident. This was a small measure of justice, as was the removal of the county prosecutor from office for failure to proceed. Another man was arrested for the crime, confessed, and is now serving life in prison. And that was a town in Essex County. Maybe Ferguson and Staten Island need new prosecutors, but the problem is bigger than any one public official. So what can we, mostly but not entirely white Unitarian Universalists, do? The brief and simple answer is that we live our lives as anti-racist activists. We need to be in solidarity with our neighbors who are the victims of structural racism. And the public violent deaths that have been in the news are just the most salient examples. Here are some other examples of structural racism. The militarization of policing, which even conservatives are now beginning to recognize was a mistake. The closing of hospitals serving poorer, mostly non-white communities. The so-called school reform movement, which to be sure includes conservative black politicians, but is an all-out assault on public education, in which black and Latino children are its early and obvious victims. And the gun-toting vigilantes, not just George Zimmerman, but those who are willing to get on the rooftops of businesses in Ferguson following the grand jury decision not to prosecute Darren Wilson. But just as important as standing up to overt racism, those of us who are white need to examine our own attitudes, our own behaviors. If you're like me, well, I'll just say, take me for an example. I'm a white person who grew up on the dominant side of the racist society, and although from a working class background, benefited and continues to benefit from that privileged position. This is a fact, no matter how careful and ethical I am in my individual behavior, and it's a fact for you, no matter how careful or ethical you are in your individual behavior. Being anti-racist is hard work, and I know I don't get it right all the time. The work is hard because it's not so much about prejudices, but about social, economic, and legal structures. There have been times of progress, including the civil rights movement of the last century, but the successes have not changed the structures. And we've just seen how the last 10 years, especially since the Supreme Court gutted the voting rights movement, politicians have moved to start shrinking the black voting rolls again. Just as much as a gun, poverty is violent, and poverty over generations is genocide. Black people today are poorer and have lower average incomes than white people. And this is true wherever the class location of black people are on average. This is a product of history, not the failings of individuals. And this is one of the issues that Black Lives Matter Network has taken on, in addition to the issue of police violence against black civilians. There are others. There's the burden of women in a society that batters their families and children. Black, queer, and trans folk bear a multiple layer of burdens in their lives, both within the black community and beyond. There are 500,000 undocumented black immigrants in the United States today. Historically, black folks with illness and disabilities have been used for experiments, and today many still struggle to get appropriate treatments and needs addressed. And I need to make one thing clear about structural racism. People are mixed into different parts of the structure. And people may or may not be prejudiced no matter where they are in that structure. Here is one example. Freddie Gray died in the custody of the Baltimore police on April 12, 2015. His spine had been damaged in his arrest, and he did not get adequate treatment. He was put into a van to take to police headquarters, but not strapped down. This was what was called, in police parlance, a rough ride. Two of the six officers involved were black, but they worked within a structure in which a rough ride for a suspect not secured in the back of the van was acceptable behavior. That's the structure. It could be applied to a white suspect too, but Baltimore is a predominantly black city, and that's part of the structure of racism also. So it should not even have to be said, but we have to say it, black lives matter. That it has to be said is an indictment of the structural racism of U.S. society. But because it has to be said, black lives matter is a powerful anti-racist statement. But saying it is not enough. We need to take the risks required to have a world in which we don't have to say it. A world in which lynching in whatever form and of whomever and by whomever is no longer behavior that goes unpunished. I want to close my remarks with a couple of sentences from the black liberation theologian James Cone. He writes, "The structure on blackness does not mean that only blacks suffer as victims of a racist society, but that blackness is an ontological symbol and a visible reality which best describes what oppression means in America. Black Lives Matter is an imperative to this minister because of the oppression that is at the core of the history of this nation and which, after these centuries, cannot be allowed to continue. And may it be so. Amen.